Welcome to Record Roulette. My name is Eamon O'Flynn. I'm here with Nathan Smith to discuss another album from the Rolling Stone 500 Greatest Albums list. This week, we have the incredible and talented Gia Mora on the show. Gia is an actress, musician, author, and about 20 other things, and she's our most prolific guest. This is her fifth time on Record Roulette. In previous episodes, we've talked about albums from The Beatles, Janet Jackson, Lou Reed, and James Taylor. They're always the most educational episodes because Gia actually knows what she's talking about, unlike some guests. This week, we need an education because Gia picked Giant Steps by John Coltrane, and I know nothing about this, or at least I didn't until I wrote last week's 101 episode. Here's the gist. Released in 1960, it's considered one of the most influential jazz albums of all time. It was added to the Library of Congress National Recording Registry in 2004. Many of the songs, including the title track, went on to become jazz standards, and in 2018, it finally achieved a gold certification almost 60 years after its release. It's on the Rolling Stone Greatest Albums list at number 232, which puts it ahead of Metallica's Black Album and Daft Punk's Discovery, and just behind John Lennon's Imagine and Damn the Torpedoes from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. It's actually one of two Coltrane albums on the list, too. The other one is A Love Supreme, which can be found way up there at number 66 all time. Pretty incredible. I did stumble over when it was released because for some reason my brain was saying 1959 as well. So I think maybe it was just a bunch of it was recorded in 1959. This is actually also a unique album in that it is the first one where the performer is a literal god. And I don't know if you guys had heard this, but after he died, a church in San Francisco, I assume a church full of cranks, although I don't want to offend anyone, but probably cranks, deified him, like literally deified him and started like worshiping him as a god. And then later on, I think it's the African Orthodox Church then made him a saint. So he is, in fact, Saint John Coltrane, which I kind of would love to know what he would think about that.
Yeah, you know, I'd seen St. Coltrane all over the place, but I just assumed it was like a, you know, a moniker of that, you know, his fans had given him, not that he'd had literal sainthood. Wow!
I mean, literal both. Sainthood. Yes,
true, I think it's both.
I do think that that's maybe the circumstances, that it's a bit of both. It's, you know, I looked this up. I was looking at his Wikipedia, right? Just like right before this. And this is something I just figured out, like just before this. Looking at Wikipedia, and one of the sections is veneration. And I was like, veneration? What? St. John Coltrane. So the, so what is it? The Yardbird Temple in San Francisco began worshiping him as God incarnate. After he died, interestingly, incarnate,
whoa,
but he was no longer incarnate. And then the African Orthodox Church, changed his status from God to a saint. And he is St. John Coltrane, African Orthodox Church. It's kind of incredible. Incredible. So we are literally talking about a saint, which I think is really funny because as with so many of these artists, you're talking about a guy who is like a heroin addict in life, who cheated on his first wife and had multiple kids with his second wife before he was divorced from his first wife. All kinds of crazy stuff. But that is the saint of jazz.
That was his first miracle.
That was his first.
The second one on the path to sainthood might have been this album.
Oh, I love it. I love it. That's great.
Yeah. Okay. So, Gia, we are going to be leaning on you very heavily for this album because, and I'm speaking for Nathan here, we know next to nothing about improvisational jazz. But before we get to talking about the album itself, I'd love to know why you picked it. So why this one? Oh,
well, I've been in love with this album since I was 15. The boy that I loved in high school, he gave me this for my 15th birthday. And because we were in jazz choir together and, you know, those jazz romances when you're 15 years old, little white kids in Colorado.
I was just about to wonder. I was like, are you a lot older than I think you are?
Yeah, I know. It's like, did you
in high school? My sweetheart gave me this album from 1960.
From 1960.
Uh-oh.
I know. We also went steady to the prom together and like had our chaperone. No, I'm just kidding. So I've loved this for a very long time. And, you know, it's such an iconic, that opening, you know, ba-da-ba-da-ba is just like you, it literally is less than a second. And you're like, boo, I know exactly what this is. And it's so classically Coltrane. Like I love that about it. My favorite track, though, is Naima. And I used to slow dance by myself in my room, imagining that I was dancing with that boy that I loved to that song, because it's the only song that is not like a freight train, you know, headed to New Orleans. You know what I mean? It is like going. Yeah. This album just books. And then you have this little respite in the, you know, second half, and you've got this slow with the, you know, bass in the octaves, boo doo doom boom, and it just lends itself to this movement that I loved, and that he could be both, you know, frenetic and legato at the same time, and that's what I like about this album. And it's so brief. I mean, it's like 30 minutes. It's really jam packed, and I also like it because, unlike a lot of other, compared to other jazz records of that time, it's a really small band, right? It's just three pieces. Mm-hmm. There's not a huge horn section, and it's not super like a lot of other hard bop where it's really, really metered out, and every arrangement is written and the parts are all written out. And it is really just letting these three guys in a single take record these songs. And it's so fun, yes, to listen to the other outtakes too, because they sound like the track we're familiar with, but not really, because they're still improvising. And so much of this is not like melodically driven. Only a couple of the songs are. But it isn't so wild, and it isn't like a Keith Jarrett album where you have to like deal with Keith Jarrett's in the middle of it. So it's very weirdly accessible, I think, as a jazz album in that sense.
I think it's kind of interesting that you mention specifically Naima, because that is the one song on this entire album that has a different lineup from the rest of the album. I made a mistake in an original version of some of the questions. We'll get to some of this, where I said it was actually three different groups of people. It was actually three different recording sessions with different groups of people. And most of it is done with the same people over a May 4th and a May 5th of 1959. And that's why I must have thought it was 1959. But that one song, it's interesting that you pick out that one song, because that one song is, it's the same bass player, Paul Chambers, who is always the same bass player. But the other two, the piano and the drums, are different guys. It's Wynton Kelly and Jimmy Cobb. So kind of interesting to pick that one out.
Yeah.
Because it does feel different from the rest of the album.
Yeah, it's so much more sparse. Like, you only get like even a little bit of the cymbal only in the second half of the song on the drums, right? Like, no hi-hat. Yeah. That's so interesting. I didn't know that. Then who plays on the rest of the tracks? Who are the other?
So the main group is Coltrane, Tommy Flanagan on piano, Paul Chambers always on bass, and Art Taylor on drums. And some of the extra ones that you were talking about, so he did an initial session with Cedar Walton on piano and Lex Humphreys on drums. And I think they are with, who was he playing with at that point? He was with Miles Davis's group, maybe? Is who he was playing with. So it just,
well, they were,
anyway,
they were,
very,
it's like,
very interesting that you specifically pulled that one.
Well,
out.
And it's sort of like this, you get to see the beginning of like where rappers are on each other's albums, because, you know, Coltrane's on Art Tatum's album, and Art Tatum is on Art Blakey's album, and Art Blakey is on Herb Albert's album. And you know what I mean? Like, and it's all just everybody's trading off, and they're all doing their own albums, but they're playing on each other's records. Bill Evans has a lot of that too. So that's so fascinating,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, but that one song. Nathan, what about you? Was I speaking out of turn? Are you, in fact, a huge jazz head?
In that respect, you are not speaking out of turn, because I'm not a huge jazz head, but I'm not completely uninitiated either. I've heard, I listened to, I guess, not a lot, but a decent amount of jazz, I would say, sort of in my late teens and parts of my 20s. Art Tatum was one that you mentioned, Gio, who I love. Coltrane, Thelonious Monk, Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, like this sort of Mount Rushmore's basically of that era of jazz. But I listened to it primarily, and this will sound dismissive, but I'll add some context, to fall asleep, only because to me it was kind of mesmerizing. Like you could, your brain sort of, I found it relaxing, but not in the sense where it's like, this is boring, but you can latch onto the bass, you can latch onto the drums, you can latch onto the piano, you can latch onto the saxophone, you could latch onto so many different instruments, and your mind would just sort of, I found, kind of just go into a dream world basically, and it would be a nice sort of thing to fall asleep to. So Coltrane in particular, like this, for whatever reason, and I'm kind of surprised I'd never really delved into this album. Like for me, the big three for Coltrane were Love Supreme, which I was interested to hear ranked as high as it did on the list, because I really like that album and know it fairly well. Blue Train, obviously, and then my favorite Things, and then like a smattering of live albums and guest appearances and everything else. But I'd never really heard too much of this album. So this to me was new. The genre is not something I'm unfamiliar with, but I've never really sort of delved deeply into, you know, to the point where saying, oh, it was this bass player who plays in this guy's group. I know there's a lot of cross-pollination, so to speak, but I'm not familiar with the names. My brother's a massive jazz fan and he could go on for hours. He might be the better Smith, in fact, to have on this podcast. If I could phone a friend, yeah, perhaps we could, yeah,
if we could just get
in
him to join, that'd, yeah, be great.
So anyway, not a total jazz head, but not completely unfamiliar either.
All right. Yeah. And so that means I am the lone one that is basically completely uninitiated, because my vast experience with jazz is probably Bleeding Gums Murphy and The Simpsons.
Who was more of a blues man,
this
I think.
It's true, yeah. Yeah,
but true. They had the song Jazz Man, I think, in the...
Yeah. Oh, in the episode, anyway, you're, yeah, right, yeah.
In the episode, they did sing Jazz Man, and he did have a saxophone, and so maybe he was a Coltrane-y kind of figure. But other than that, I kind of feel like I've never really gotten into it. I mean, there's a lot of stuff I've listened to, and I really enjoyed that. It feeds directly off of it. One of the earliest albums we did was from Nina Simone, and we talked a bunch about this, and I listened to some of her stuff that was more jazzy than the stuff we listened to for that episode. But I would say that it's not something I've really ever gone into. As a result, I kind of often felt like, I was just like, I don't know how to talk about this. That this is one of the bigger challenges of this entire show, for me. It's almost up there with like Shakira, when we did the Shakira album and it was in Spanish and I don't speak Spanish. Like you're like, I'm trying to understand this, but I don't speak this language. I don't know this language well enough to appreciate it as much as maybe someone who has listened to it a lot more or has a bit more breadth as Nathan does. I promised everyone that this would be educational. Damn it, it's going to be. Normally, my notes have a ton about lyrics and vocals, and as I said, this doesn't have any. So, Gia, can you tell us, how do you judge jazz? How do we know this is good?
Oh, I don't know that that's even a question I can answer. I mean, like, how do we know that it's good? I think the one thing that...
I know that's a really hard one, because that's the same thing with all music. It's like you could listen to anything and be like, how do you know that this is good? But it's so much easier when you have lyrics and you can say, this is really well written.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're having to then identify whether or not the song evokes an emotion for you and what emotion it evokes. And it made me really think a lot about the titles. Like if you think about them as poems and how the title would... you know, is basically what the first line of the poem, that I think that's a big piece of it. This isn't a particularly like political album, although a lot of other albums around that time, especially around the civil rights movement, they have a lot more sort of military march kind of feel to them that this doesn't have. So I think, Nathan, your idea that it's sort of dreamy, this particular album is very dreamy. And I think we know it's good because it, despite the fact that it's quite abstract, it does still have an arc, right? That we have this this big takeoff, and we keep going, and then we build, and then we have our little Naima moment, and then we go back again to the train, and we're in our 11 o'clock number. So I think as an experience, as an album, it has a shape to it, so that tells us that it's good. It feels cohesive, even though you've said the lineup changes. So it doesn't feel like a soundtrack where you're doing a mishmash of things, or like it was recorded over too long of a period of time, and they sort of forgot what they were doing. It feels very live. Live too. It is. I mean, it's not, there's no overdubbing. There's nothing else there. So no. I think we know it's good because the musicianship level to record live like that, it has to be extraordinary. But the other thing is, like any jazz musician will tell you, we don't know if Coltrane played a wrong note because he didn't believe in wrong notes. Exactly. So, yeah. You know, and that's Monk's whole philosophy, right? There are no wrong notes. And then the other thing about jazz, right, is that, which is so funny to talk about Coltrane, that if music is what happens in the space between the notes, he doesn't leave any space. Like,
no, he's going.
Yeah, where is the breath? Where is the, like, there? It's like, I think what is interesting about this is there's no, we're not, this isn't an album about anticipation. This isn't like a buildup. It's not like a slow, like Arctic Monkeys kind of thump, pop, thump, pop, where you're just kind of anticipating. It just is a punch in the face, and it says, like, look at this, look at this. You cannot look away.
100%. Yep, 100%. Nathan, do you want to add anything to that? You surprised me with your with your knowledge or experience with jazz. So, what would you add?
Well, I guess like this is kind of where I struggle because I sort of had the same thought as you, Eamon. Like I like it and I think it's good. And on a very sort of open-ended question, like how do you define whether it's good? I don't know how to do that, and I don't know if anybody can. But I guess what I struggle with, sort of in a broader sense, in terms of especially this kind of jazz where it's kind of loosely melodic at times, but largely it's more about feel as Gia was indicating, is that, and this gets maybe too philosophical for what we're trying to talk about, but who cares? We're talking about a saint after all. So you can indulge me, but
or a god.
Like is based on this particular style of jazz where, you know, there are no wrong notes. It's about the space in between the notes. Like is Coltrane capable or, is Miles Davis capable in this style of being bad? Like, could they do a bad song in this style? Yeah. And if they can't, or if you can't really tell what it is, I think it's hard to tell whether this is, you know, good or great. Like, if it's just sort of a, and maybe it, again, this is getting way too deep and way too whatever, but it transcends kind of your traditional sensibilities of what's good or bad, and it's more just about a feeling. Because I don't know, I like the album and I like all the songs, but I don't know if in this style, he or anybody else who's attempting this style is capable of doing what would be considered a bad song. Like, so long as you're doing this style, is the style itself kind of the product versus the individual moments? Like, there's not going to be a hit, obviously, or anything where it's like, this is a really great song, this is a bad song. It's either good or it just doesn't work. So I think it's really difficult genre, at least this kind of jazz, to evaluate in that more traditional sense, where the usual kind of metrics fly out the window. Like if there's no bad note, if there like it's about something more than your typical kind of melody.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's something that that you said, Gia, about the about them almost being, if you think about that, the title of the track being, you know, the first line in a poem or the first line in a lyric, you know, this is like Naima is the name of his first wife. Saida, from the Saida's song flute, is his adopted daughter. And if you kind of think about those songs as their sounds, right? Like there is a softness to Naima. Like it is like there's a specific feel to it. And if you listen to Saida's song flute, it is it kind of sounds like a kid who's 8 to 10 years old. Like there's like a bounciness to it and like a, you know, happiness to it in certain ways. And it's like, that's how old the kid was at the time. Like it's like you're seeing something really personal, but it's very oddly coming through no lyrics, no vocally telling the story. You're hearing it in the performance. And One thing I'll maybe also add to this, because I was going to move on anyway to talking a little bit about Coltrane's playing and see how you guys would describe it. I'll say at first that I think I described it as like frenetic and like almost impossibly dexterous. Like at times, you know, I was blown away at times by the playing, not because I could appreciate, exactly what was happening from a musical standpoint, but almost the sheer like physical exertion necessary to achieve what he was doing is crazy to me. Like I did very briefly play saxophone in like elementary school. I know it's not super easy. And on Countdown, he is like, there is no space. When is he breathing?
You know, that track just, I mean, to start with the drums and then just coming, and you're like, oh my God, I can't, you know, they tell you as a singer that, or that as a musician, you're supposed to be able to sing whatever you are playing. I can't even sing it. I can't even, it's so interesting because frenetic is the word I would absolutely use to describe his. You're exactly right.
Yeah, it's just, it's all over. Like, he's moving so quickly. And the other thing that I would maybe add there, and this is something I obviously did not get from listening to it, but reading about it later, is that he's experimenting and building on this sheets of sound concept that he'd been working on, which is, I saw the term sheets of sound, and I was like, oh, is this like a proto-wall of sound concept or something like that? And it is not really. It's way more complicated than I am capable of understanding in terms of it's how you improvise, essentially. It's how you kind of improvise on I'm going to just say improvise across chords and on chords. And I think anyone listening who really understands this stuff is going to be like, well, that's totally wrong. But it was complicated to the point where I read multiple articles trying to understand what was happening. I was like, my base in music theory is not strong enough to understand this. And he's doing it live. He is whatever he is performing. You've had people listen to it since then and say, you wouldn't believe what he has just done here. And I think that that's probably Nathan. How would you describe his playing?
Well, obviously, the playing, I think, is that's something that you can objectively say is exceptional. Like, I don't think anybody, even if you don't like the music, you can't say this guy's not a virtuoso. And not just Coltrane, mm-hmm. but the other musicians on the album and on the songs. Like, they're clearly, you know, elite, like sort of, and to jump from band to band and just kind of seamlessly drop into these songs, like you're clearly at a very, very high level beyond pop music or rock music or whatever other kind of genre. Like, you have to be among the very best. And then just to not only be as technically sound, but as creative as they are, and be able to play off each other as well as they do, which is the other thing that obviously, you know, just given the frequency, the saxophone is the first thing most people I think would pick up. But when you start listening to other, you know, the drums and the bass and other instruments kind of going on, like you pick up, there's a lot going on there too. Like, these aren't just sort of your traditional backing musicians. Like, they're doing some pretty crazy things too. So I think anybody, regardless of whether you like, you know, the songs or the album, you can certainly, I would hope, appreciate the talent that goes into playing this kind of music.
I do kind of feel for those guys who didn't make it on the album. There is like the first recording is all those extra songs that you hear. If you go on Spotify or something, is actually the first recording. And he was like, I'm not quite happy with this. I'm going to come back into the studio. But you're, as you said, Gia, they're recording live. And they're improvising this. This isn't like, hey guys, here's how the whole song lays out. Let's practice it a few times. This is, all right, we're hitting record, and we're going to put something out there that feels polished almost. Like, it sounds so good somehow that you would almost not know that it was improvised.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it is improvised, but like they'd have had a lead sheet that like will tell them, here's the form, right? Yeah. And then, but I think to speak to just jazz in general, that's the style. Like, that's the history that they come from, right? You learn, you know, how chords work and how melodies work over those chords. And then you take songs that you know, and then you improvise over them. And like, Bye Bye Blackbird. Everybody knows Bye Bye Blackbird, but, you know, the way that Ella sings it is very different than the way that Nina sings it, or that, you know, K-Star sings it, or whatever. So I think there's an something similar in this, in that, like, the reason that they can come together and sit down and be handed a lead sheet and, you know, read the few things together and then just go is because of that virtuoso nature that is not just with Coltrane, but with all of the others. And I do think there is just some sort of, like, you know, even if you don't care about, like, the fancy schmancy, or not even fancy schmancy, like, Botticelli. If even if you don't care about Botticelli or, like, the Birth of Venus, you can't deny, like, my God, like, that takes talent to paint that. The Sistine Chapel, like, I had to, you can be a-religious or, you know, anti-religious and still be blown away by that. And I think there's something to, akin to that in that, but the structure of jazz just lends itself to, you know you're, you have a set of rules and then you, you just work within them. And, and like the more you listen to, I can't say this about Coltrane, but other jazz musicians that you listen to, you'll hear them repeating some of the same musical lines because they become sort of your voice in a sense. And I think you can kind of pick up on that the more and more you listen to it, because you'll see how they basically relate melodically to the music. But it's none of that is possible without, like you said, this incredible base of theory and musicianship. And then I think the other thing that we, just to go back very briefly about what makes it good, is the precision, right? Like the precision is so killer. And that is hard bop. Full stop. I mean, like, we have big band and all of that, but that's rehearsed, that's written out, that's very, very different. This is as tight as that without that kind of level.
100%. There's something about this that it's not the same. There's a lot of differences in a lot of ways, but when we talked about Stevie Wonder album, like, Stevie's whole thing is, like, every millisecond I'm going to control. I'm going to make this pristine and perfect. And when I was listening to this, I was just thinking about how again, like, use the term polished, it sounded like, it's just, they are just masters at what they're doing. And that's what you're hearing. You're hearing people who just are the best at what they're doing show up and put together something live that is incredible. Nathan, I'd written this question thinking you had zero background in jazz, but clearly that was a lie. You know, what did you like about this experience of being kind of forced to really sit down and listen to a jazz album?
Oh, I don't know. I think, again, to sort of go over some of the territory we've covered, is just to I guess maybe, as I sort of think about it in real time now, is the lack of any sort of traditional expectation. Like, you're not waiting for a chorus to hit you or a big sort of solo. I mean, there's solos through it, but I mean, in a traditional sense where the vocals drop out. So it's just, I guess it's the overall element of surprise. And it's very, I mean, there are other people, as we've outlined earlier, that do this kind of jazz, but generally speaking, this is a major departure from what you'd consider pop music or even traditional kind of song structure. So, you know, even basic pop music can still surprise at times, but this is kind of a surprise literally every second. You don't know what's going to come. And so you essentially just kind of turn yourself over to that and just kind of sit back and completely consume it. So I guess on a deeper level, that would be the most enjoyable part of this. And then I think the other thing is just, again, there's, I don't know, you could listen to this 100 times and probably not pick out everything. So that idea that you're never going to kind of fully digest this album, or albums like it, just given the complexity of it, the talent of those who are playing on it. So I think it's compelling in that sense.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you made about pop. So pop music, I think, in many cases depends on people being able to predict what's about to happen next. You know, like, I think you in some ways want people to. It struck me, oddly enough, just because you mentioned that, I was listening to, of all things, Weezer, their Blue album earlier today,
and the song "Certain." When you're steeped in Coltrane, it's a natural.
Yeah, it's a natural next step. But there's a song called Surf Wax America, and there's a point where it kind of, like, that album is their first album, and it has a very strong alternative feel to it, and it comes out at a time when there's, like, grunge is big, like, punk, the punky kind of thing is kind of big, and they were definitely playing off of that. But there's a point where that song sounds like it's gonna be just that, and then just kind of end, and then it hits a wall, and it stops. And then it just suddenly plays very light guitar in the kind of background and multiple different vocals, which you don't really think of with Weezer necessarily, but multiple different vocals kind of harmonizing to sing the chorus. And I remember thinking how odd that was, because it's such an unexpected thing to happen in alternative music at that exact moment in time, that to stop a song at a time when you have the Soundgardens of the world and you have the Nirvanas of the world doing their thing, and you're stopping a song and getting really light and singing falsetto quietly. Anyway, that's kind of going in a very odd, random direction. But the thing I really liked about this, as someone who has not listened to really any of this, is it was recorded live, and it had this feeling, this lively feeling. If I closed my eyes, I could almost imagine the people playing it in a way that I can't do it with highly produced music. That there was just, it felt lively, it felt like it was all happening right then, and this is happening in 1959. Like, that's, to me, that's that crazy moment of, you know, taking you basically through time, or almost showing you that time is totally meaningless when you have genius or you have great music.
So,
okay, given your experiences up to this point, I'm assuming most of the people listening are not giant jazz fans. So what would you tell a complete neophyte who wants to experience and enjoy jazz for the first time? Like, what should they do to kind of mentally prepare themselves for this sort of thing? Gia, any ideas?
I think Nathan's idea that just wait to be surprised, I think, is really keen. I think Nathan's other observation to take the time to separate out and listen to the different instruments and listen to the different, how they're speaking to each other. Because there is a lot of call and response. It's not as obvious as, you know, some forms of music, but there is a lot of it here, and it is a conversation. So I think that's the other thing, is like, imagine if people didn't use words and they just communicated through their instruments, and they're literally trying in many ways to, like, achieve that duende that they talk about in flamenco, which is literally like calling up the spirits, right? And I think there is something to that. That's why jazz people have the reputation for being as snooty as they are, is because, like, it's very serious. Like, it is not a game, but it's extremely playful. So it's like, if you speak the language and you can be in that little world with them and be on the journey with them, you get to go on a secret journey that other people aren't privy to. And you can use all of your senses if you're listening to it live, because you can watch what they're doing. You can, you know, feel the sound waves. You can listen to the different instruments. I mean, I don't know, smell-wise, I'm sure you can have a nice drink while you're enjoying it, but I can't get all the senses in there. But I think that imaginative, you know, playful, conversational space, and to just, yeah, be ready to be surprised. Nathan, you nailed it, man.
Well, I was going to actually pick up on what you said, because I thought it was an excellent point when you're talking about the snootiness associated with jazz, which I think is a real thing. And so my advice on top of what you said is to kind of resist the urge to naturally strike back against, you know, these elite class of people that like jazz and instinctively say, well, this sucks. They don't know what they're talking about. It's just awful music for, you know, academics. Like, a lot of those people like it. But I think it can be universal. And there's a reason why music like this, and this in particular, has stood the test of time and will continue to stand the test of time, because it is for the masses. But I think, given the reputation that sort of comes with this kind of music, that it's for, you know, intelligent, sophisticated people, which it can be, but it can be for the masses. And it can be for people that don't have any musical training, that just connect with it for some reason across, you know, cultures and countries and ethnicities and ages and all the rest of it. So don't go in looking to kind of tear it down right away because you want to prove that you know something everybody else doesn't and turn it into kind of a class war. I think you just sort of accept it and try to get into it on a very basic level. There has to be at least some entry point for everybody. And then if you come back for multiple lessons, I think it becomes more and more meaningful. But I think the points you've made and the idea of not resisting the urge to say, well, this is just, you know, a bunch of egghead kind of university students that are wanting to sound smarter than me, so I'm going to instinctively reject it, avoid that urge, and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
And, you know, as someone, I'm going to steal something Gia said, but not in this episode. So when we were talking about Janet Jackson, Gia said, what we should do is you need to be standing up and you need to be dancing along with it to really feel this music and to experience this music. And, you know, I spent a lot of time listening to this at my computer doing work and doing that kind of stuff. And I was not, it was fine. And cause you can focus on those experiences with different, instruments and everything. But oddly enough, and it's not the best sound system, you know, Bluetooth speaker, but I had it playing while making dinner one night. And so I'm standing and I'm moving around and there's kind of a rhythm to what I'm doing in a kitchen. And having it play there almost just gave it a different element. Like it was almost, and so as it was happening, I was thinking, I'm enjoying this album more than I've enjoyed this album in the previous five or six listens that I'd done. And if the first thing I thought of was, and Gia, not, you know, she got it perfectly with Janet Jackson, which is sometimes you need to just stand up and experience the music a little bit in a different way.
Oh, I love that you had the somatic experience of the music, right? That it is, and I think that is, jazz is physical, even Coltrane, like you mm-hmm. said, the physical capability to have that kind of breath control. Also, while you're completely out of your brain on drugs, like and to keep that kind of control, I don't understand how he does it. I mean, I think that's also part of his just, maybe he's like Sherlock Holmes in that he has that, mm-hmm. like you need that to kind of take you down.
You need something.
You know, as opposed to bring you up. Like I have to just kind of be where everybody else is and that's where I feel safe. Yeah,
I can't explain. I always feel that way with all these artists. Basically, with every artist, where you're like, this person was on a huge amount of drugs. How did they actually do what they're doing? Like, how did they do what we're hearing? Because like, I'm not on a whole bunch of drugs and I can barely play a guitar. You know, yep. how are they on this? Yeah, like how are? I just don't get it. I don't get it. Okay, what was your favorite song on Giant Steps? I think you already told us, right, Gia?
Yeah, I love Naima, but I think Saidi's flute song is my second favorite just because it's, I didn't know it was about his stepdaughter, and it made me, now you're saying, I'm like, oh, it's like a game of hide and seek. You know, like...
A bunch of them are different members of the family. Like, I think there's another one, too.
Cousin Mary is the second track.
There's Cousin Mary, which is one of his cousins, and then Mr. PC is the initials of bassist Paul Chambers.
Oh,
so the bassist
I was gonna
for the album.
Ask.
So I don't know. It doesn't say anything else. I'm cheating by looking at a Wikipedia article, which is not always recommended. But that is So there a bunch of the songs are based on people or have something to do with the energy that specific people have. And one of them was in the room and playing the song, which is interesting. Nathan, what about you? Favorite song?
I find it difficult. I'll just go with Giant Steps. I think, you know, it sets the tone really nicely and it's fairly indicative of, for the most part, of what's to come. So, and it is a melody that, despite the fact that I don't think I've consciously heard it, I recognized it to a certain extent. So I was more familiar with that. So I think I'm sort of naturally more drawn to that for the time being, but it's very difficult to pick sort of a song because I think this is more kind of a reflection of the work at large than it is kind of individual songs. But if you're forcing me to pick one, that would be the one.
All right. For me, it's Mr. PC. And I think the reason why is I always like, I like the first songs and the last songs and albums so much because I think they try and achieve so much. But specifically that one, because in that one, more than I think any other place, he really gives the other musicians there the space to do their thing. You have, you know, the piano really does show up in that one. The drums really get their own little window of opportunity to shine as well. Oddly enough, the bass does not, but it's always there in this music. The bass is just so central to everything that I don't think it really needs to have that solo opportunity, but it's fun to hear that in some ways call and response. The drum bit is very clearly a call and response. It's like listening to the Beastie Boys but with drums and a saxophone.
Totally. Yes.
Yeah, it's call and response. One bad opinion time. So I went and looked at Amazon. It had 1,558 ratings for this album, which actually surprised me. I thought there's no chance it was going to have a big number. And like there, we've done albums where it's had barely anything. It's a 4.7 star average. 2% of them are one star. This is one of them. It's called Geez, What a Ham. I don't really know why. It's by someone named Spinky de Galore in 2001. 2001, this review came in. I don't know how it's on their website. I mean, did Amazon exist in 2001? I don't know. Here it is. Golly, all my friends rant and rave about John Coltrane and how good he is. He just knows how to play really fast. His solos sound like he's making them up as he goes along. This guy needs to take some lessons from some real sax masters like Kenny G.
That is hilarious.
Sounds like he's making them up as he goes along, guys.
This is so funny. Kenny G.
I love Kenny G. I did think, I did cut out a little bit where he continued to talk about Kenny G for another couple of sentences. I think this is weird. These ones like this are weird because this is from 2001. So I don't know if there was a culture yet of, you know, purposely like shitposting, like putting stuff out there and being like, I'm just making fun of this. And so I can't tell with this one. Sometimes it's very clear that someone's purposefully, you know, just doing something just to get a response from people. But this one, I don't know. I can't tell. But anyway, I thought it was good. I thought it was fun. Before we wrap up, see, I keep forgetting to change this question. It's would you recommend it and why? But Gia, you've already recommended it. That's why we're listening. That's why we listened to it. So, who would you recommend it to? What kind of other music do you think people like? If someone likes certain other type of music, they would like this.
Oh, if you,
that's a tough question. I'm just dropping.
No, this is a good question. If you like 80s sax, sax has not gotten its due in pop music in a good long while. Because if you hear a sax solo, with the exception of that one like wedding song that came out 10 years ago that had the sax solo in it, you don't hear sax in popular music. So I think if you like sax at all, you have to listen to Coltrane. That's definitely it. And if you like really kind of mysterious music that, like you said, Eamon, you need to listen to 3, 4, 5, 6 times before you really dig into it, then that's absolutely who I would recommend it to. And I'd also recommend it to anybody interested in just like music history, because he's obviously, you know, just like one of the people that if you want to know anything about jazz, you got to know a little bit about Coltrane.
Sounds about right. Nathan, you did not recommend this album. At least that's not the reason why we're listening to it. Would you recommend it to other people?
Yes, I would. And the types of people I'd recommend it to, I think Gia's list is pretty thorough, but I recommend it to people sort of like you, Eamon, who have it doesn't have to be sort of super eclectic taste, but somebody that likes more than one genre. You could even just like the hits in, you know, country and rock, or you like alternative and some hip hop. Like, there's got to be a bit of curiosity in your musical palette to kind of recommend this to somebody. And again, they don't have to be into deep cuts or demo recordings or you know, B-sides or whatever, but just somebody that has a bit of diversity to their musical palette, and not in a snooty way. Just, again, you could like mainstream country, but also like some alternative music, or also like some classical music. It doesn't matter. Just a bit of diversity to your palette. And I think this would would be enough to kind of dip your toe into the water and hopefully swim out into the deep end eventually.
All right. What I would say is if you want to feel like Stanley Tucci in a kitchen making food, just put some jazz on, put some Coltrane on. This album gets it done.
Get your Tucci on.
That's it for today. So get your Tucci on. That's it for today. Thank you for joining us, Gia. Is there anything you want to plug before we sign off?
Oh, sure. I just, it's not really just anymore, especially when this comes out. I released a new music video in January called Take Some Action to Get Some Action. And it's all based on data from OkCupid that found out that caring about the climate was the number one date breaker. So if you want to get some, you got to take some action. So check it out on GiaMora.com.
All right, we'll share that link. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure. So great to be here.
That's all for today. Check out Record Roulette on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at RR Music Pod. Rate and review this podcast wherever you can. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your favorite show. Or listen for free at recordroulettepodcast.com. Music in this episode is from Lemon Music Studio. Thank you for listening to Record Roulette. Until the next spin, goodbye.